Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 92nd episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is letting the nothingness into your swing. I'm joined by Martin Wells. He is the author of No One Playing, The Essence of Mindfulness in Golf and in Life. The publisher is Mantra Books. It's an imprint of John Hunt Publishing. Martin has worked as a psychotherapist in the National Health Service for over 30 years, in addition to teaching mindfulness to other patients and staff. He lives in Bristol, England, and at age 70 is still a single-figure handicap golfer. He's also played senior amateur and semi-professional soccer for nearly 20 years. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So let's start out with just a brief sense of what's the book about.
Well, it's a story of a strange meeting between me and an Asian gentleman that appears on the first tee of my golf course. I'm supposed to be playing with my brother, but he can't make it because he's ill. So this guy turns up, and he knows nothing about golf, and asks me if he can come round with me. And I'm sort of initially a bit unsure about this because I think I'm going to have to explain this rather complex game to him. But as it turns out, he teaches me about the inner game. And that's the whole premise of the book, I guess.
Okay. So the Beatles went to India, but you import India or someone from Asia as your companion here.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Okay. Okay, and the structure of the book, you might want to mention the 18 holes and all.
Yes, thank you. There's 19 chapters, so 18 holes and the 19th hole, and an epilogue, and each one, I guess, contains a lesson about the game and about the inner game. And the first three or four chapters I started 30 years ago, and so it's only been in lockdown in the last couple of years that I finished the last four or five chapters. And looking back, I couldn't really have written those any earlier than I did.
Okay. And the book is lovingly written, including some delicious descriptions of how the ball dribbles back away from the hole and so forth. Having played enough golf to experience those agonies, I certainly appreciate it. Also lovely descriptions of the golf holes, the course itself that you kind of constructed through a potpourri of courses there on the west coast of England and so forth. You want to just briefly describe that as well?
Yes. Yeah. I suppose that's been part of my love for golf is the terrain that we play on, and particularly links golf, the seaside courses that are so wild and challenging to the golfer, but also beautiful to the eye. And yes, as you say, there's quite a few of the courses are based in Scotland. Each of the 18 chapters is based on a hole, and there's even a prize at the end of the book if anyone can guess them all.
Sure. And they did sound kind of mouthwatering, I must say. The descriptions were lovely. And although I'm not an avid golfer, I thought, geez, I really need to grab the clubs and head on out to the western coast of England. So in the intro, or actually on the back cover of the book, as part of your bio intro, it mentions that there was a kind of an epiphany, a pivot moment in your life regarding a talk you heard by a French psychiatrist. It seems that that's probably instrumental. I know you have a gentleman from, you know, Asia who's with you in the book, but it seems as if there's an alter ego, this French psychiatrist, probably hanging over in some fashion. So I want to give you a chance to elucidate.
Well, even with the French psychiatrist, there's a tradition that goes back to India, because his teacher's teacher was Ramana Maharshi from India. So it's in that tradition anyway. But yes, what happened was I, about 20 years ago now, I went to a talk at the Royal College of Psychiatrists on meditation, basically mindfulness. And the talks in the morning were, you know, with PowerPoints and research figures and statistics and things, interesting. But in the afternoon, this French psychiatrist stood up. He didn't have any notes or any PowerPoint or any research statistics. And he just stood up and said, in order to be a psychiatrist, you must completely forget you are a psychiatrist. And then he didn't say anything else for probably 2 minutes, something like that. And then he said something similar to that 2 minutes later, like almost like ringing a bell. It was more of a meditation than a talk. And of course, that first statement and the implications of that first statement and the way he delivered the course was an extraordinary experience for me, and one where all the sort of striving and searching for improvement, not just on the sports field, on the golf course, but in life as a psychotherapist and mindfulness teacher, that all fell away into just a sort of presence, in a way of being alive without expectation or without goals, without direction. And it was a mixture of what he said and the way he said it, and we've become colleagues and friends since then, and worked together, and it's been an amazing liberation for me.
Huh, no, that does sound like a wonderful delivery that he gave, including the way he did it. I mean, I've spoken at conferences in, 35 countries, but one I always remember is actually was very near the White House, a grand old hotel. And the woman delivered the entire speech in a whisper, essentially. And at first I thought, have you lost your voice? And then I realized it was part of the whole message, which was she was trying to go unorthodox, but more intimate. And it just was a wonderfully reflective talk. And by the time it was done, I was like, what a coup de grace. What a wonderful, you know, presentation. So let's stay with a few things then. We're going to get into golf quite specifically a bit later on. But there's a seems to be a pretty important comment. You said the zone finds you versus getting into the zone. And if you can, you know, say a bit about that, and then maybe you have a couple of other mindful tips that follow from that sure. statement.
Sure. Yes. And it's a paradoxical the paradoxical nature of meditation practice, and actually, as you say, we'll come to that, where that is in golf and sport as well. But we'd love to be able to find the zone. How do I get in the zone, in a sense? And that's often asked. Or how do I meditate to find peace? And there's the paradox that often comes up in meditation and in these teachings, is that we are peace. So there's no way to peace. Peace is what we are. So in that sense, we can't find it. The only thing we can do is allow ourselves to be found by it, in a sense, reminded of our true home.
I like that. It makes me think of a different moment in college where the student was trying to brown nose the professor. We were discussing William Faulkner, and he says to the teacher, with no understanding, obviously, of the concept, he says, "Does Faulkner have any advice on how we can get free will?"
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes, exactly. In Chinese, it's called wei wu wei. It's the practice of no practice. So there's an obvious paradox in that. It's absurd, yes, to the Western mind, to the binary mind. It's absurd. But actually, there's a deep truth in it. Because as soon as you're trying, and an example again from Jean-Marc, sometimes he will say, intention is in tension. So if we have that intention, then it automatically brings a tenseness into the body and into the mind. And of course, that's not the zone. So you automatically step out of the zone with that tenseness in the body.
Well, the zone is a lovely thing when you can get there. I can remember, all the best shots I've ever made in any sport have all just happened. Even one day where I think I made, honestly, about 16 of 18 shots in basketball, including one from half court at the end of the game. I mean, it just, someone came over to me at the end and he put his finger against me and went zzz, like I was on fire. A beautiful thing.
And the challenge is, of course, you can't manufacture that. No. Much as you'd like to, and it's, in a sense, it's the essence of non-duality. We can't sort of get there because we are there. We can only know what we're not. So we can observe the workings of the mind and the tensions in the body, so that as we observe them, they fall away, and then of course, then the zone is more available to us.
Sure. Now, you mentioned the word absurdity a bit ago, and one of the statements that struck my attention in the book was you said, much of golf is absurd.
Yes.
Can you say more, please?
Well, I'd probably have to ask my wife to answer that, because
she thinks it's definitely absurd.
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely absurd. What the hell are you doing? And it sort of relates to the previous thing we were talking about in a way, because there is an absurdity in us trying, in thinking that we can control something. I always laugh when a sportswoman comes onto the interview afterwards and says, I felt in control. I was in control. And I'm always thinking to myself, no, you weren't. That's an illusion, and that's part of the absurdity of the game, that we might imagine we're in control, and we might imagine that ego has finally worked it out so that we're on top of this. But any golfer knows that as soon as you start to feel that egoic pride or sense of control, then there's hubris. You're going to fall flat on your face. You're going to knock it in the lake or hit an air shot or something. And that's the game. And that's the beauty of the game. It's a great teacher in itself.
Yeah. Well, the biggest lies in life, of course, are the ones we tell ourselves.
Yes.
And we're both former midfielders in soccer, what you would call football, of course. And I think that was probably the sport I played best, and in part because I didn't have time to think. I was just in the flow. As a center midfielder, I thought of myself as a hawk just circling, and the ball was the prey, and my goal was to seize it as often as possible on behalf of myself and my team. And it was that circling motion and just staying in motion. The first principle of physics, I believe, is a body in motion tends to stay in motion. And I tried to live that principle as best I could. So there was another comment, just to take this a bit deeper, because obviously, you do work in, psychology. And you also say those of us with deeper wounds to our self-esteem feel these poor shots in golf are confirmation of what we knew already. So, I mean, this is not a light book. It really does have significance to it. And it does go to the inner game of golf, and which takes us to the inner being of the person playing golf. So can you say a bit about that particular comment, which got my attention?
Yes. It's It's a really important part of the book, I think. And I suppose in a way the book's a memoir. So I know for me that sport has, in transactional analysis, we call it counter script. So being good at sport, being sort of admired by colleagues or as you say, on a soccer pitch, being part of something that's successful or works well, it has been an amazing sort of balm to a much younger part of me that was very lacking in confidence, very shy, very afraid of people, and very sort of doubting of my a capacity to be loved, because my parents were very loving and very supportive, but to really make an influence or to have a voice. And I would right into my 20s and 30s, I would never say anything in a group, or only if I'd heard everyone else in the group speak, so I knew I was sort of safe. And there's an ethnic background to that, in the sense that my mother's German and I grew up in the 1950s in the UK. And of course, being German in this country at that time would have been, I mean, my mother's never really spoken about it, but it would have been really, really difficult time for her. And so I learned to hide that part of me, which would have also felt to me, and I know it did, as a bad part of me, something to be ashamed of, to be guilty about.
Well, I do know from the 1966 World Cup, wasn't the English crowd chanting to the Germans, "We won the war"? Something very much like that. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, and you can imagine me in the playground, age 7 or 8 or something, you know, being on the side of the English army, not saying that I'm German.
Yes.
So I learned to hide that. You know, I learned to hide that and cover it, really. So sport became a great opportunity to do that.
Well, I can certainly relate in that my family moved to Italy for 2 years when I was a boy. My father worked for the 3M company. I didn't know language at first, but I found myself in an Italian first grade in a fishing village, and I could only do the math unit. And honestly, it took me until graduate school before I spoke in class. I got to Brown University. I said, I have to finally break through here. I have to talk in class. I very nearly didn't. I remember we finished the first, we were discussing a poem by the British poet Andrew Marvell, and I hadn't said a word. I knew the poem intimately. I studied it at Oxford, and finally I said, I don't think we've really discussed the poem. And the teacher said, "What are you talking about?" And then I had to defend myself. So then I had to explain. So I finally did talk indeed. But staying with that, because you mean the book is autobiographical to a degree, and you mentioned your relationship with your father, and you had different politics, it sounded like, and quite possibly a different sensibility when it's all said and done. And you mentioned something that got my attention again, which is that you said men often have a hard time really being intimate with others. And my mom would even take that comment and say, this is a real typical conversation between guys. This is as close as they get often. I will meet you at the green.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So why is it that men seem to have this being afraid of true intimacy? And of course, they're sometimes afraid of being afraid itself.
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, it's strongly cultural, isn't it? We can see it changing now. And if we stay in the culture of sport, for example, there's a lot, certainly in the UK and I think in the States as well, there's a lot more sports people talking about their vulnerabilities, about their depression and their anxiety. Yes. And certainly, in our era when we were playing sport and when we were young, that sort of thing did not happen. And of course, the message to us as young men would have been, yeah, don't show your feelings, don't have your feelings, certainly don't express them. So there is a cultural shift. And it was a very powerful cultural influence when I was growing up. And I went to an all-boys school. Most of the staff were male as well. So it was an extraordinary sort of hypnosis into how to be, which left out a whole range of possibilities in terms of feelings, tenderness, intimacy, grief, which of course in a way drew me into psychotherapy, where I learned a huge amount from my own therapy and my own group therapy and supervision. You know, it was a great gift to me in that sense.
Sure. No, I think, you know, I've read George Orwell's writings about going to boarding school, and the amount of tenderness allowed and showed, it was minuscule. But now we have Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka and others who, you know, women obviously in both those cases, but, you know, leading the charge to bring these things in. But they're not the only ones, but certainly there is that movement. So we have about 10 minutes left. I want to move to the game of golf itself specifically, if we might, for a bit. So we've just been discussing fear. So I can't resist going to the most infamous meltdown on a golf course ever that I know of, which is Van de Velde's 1999 Open Championship. As a trained eye and as a psychotherapist, I imagine you've watched the video. You probably even watched it live as it was unfolding. And maybe you want to choose something else. So there's other meltdowns, but boy, I'd be interested on your perspective.
Yes, yeah. I mean, first, I did watch it live, and of course, any golfer or most golfers would find that excruciating just to watch the meltdown and the unfolding. And it is about golf, but it, of course, also as a psychotherapist and a mindfulness teacher, it's the power of the human mind, and the human mind has an enormous capacity both for creativity and development, but also for undermining itself, And that process that we watch when Van de Velde just went into meltdown like that is the mind at its worst, in a sense, unraveling and completely leaving the person in doubt, but the body sort of shaking with the lack of confidence, and so that all the things he's learned suddenly disappear.
And did he ever recover? Did he ever win any major championships?
I don't know that he did. I don't think he won a major. I think he might have played in some tournaments and done okay.
Because, you know, Jana Novotná, the Czech tennis player, you know, had a famous meltdown at Wimbledon, but she came back and won it later, and she was really a dear person. I was so happy for her.
Yeah, it's great when people come back from that, isn't it? It's wonderful to see.
Yeah.
But it's the power of the mind. And I, just a quick example, I was doing a mindfulness group in our health service here, and this woman, a Scottish woman, had been, she'd had psychotic depression and anxiety for 20 years or so. And she'd been in a colleague's group, a mindfulness group. And I said to her, What helped you? Well, you know, what did you learn? And she said, "Oh, that's easy. I know I'm not my thoughts. I now know I'm not my thoughts." And this was absolutely liberating to her, because, of course, you know, her thoughts had been, you know, as a depressive person, failure. You're useless. You're a waste of space. And for her to realize that she's not her thoughts, absolutely liberating, and the key to the book, in a sense, and of course, the problem with the meltdowns is we absolutely identify with the thoughts, and they're influencing us. So we're not sitting back and thinking, "Whoa, I'm having a thought of putting it in that river off the tee here," and that's where the source of the meltdown comes.
Sure, or the totalizing, you know, I missed that shot and I'm a failure in life, period.
Exactly,
you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it links to your previous question, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the book has very early on, of course, that delicious quote from Bobby Jones, the length of a golf course is 5.5 inches, the space between your ears. That's as good as they come.
It's so clear, isn't it?
Yeah. So I've got to ask you something. This will be a tough question, but it's a multiple guess question. So I happen to be a facial coder. That's my practice in psychology. So I read expressions from the face. It goes back to Da Vinci and Charles Darwin. So one time I was invited by the women's golf coach at Arizona State, which is a perennial powerhouse in America for collegiate sports, particularly golf often. And she arranged for, I think it was three, maybe four serious amateur golfers, ones who entered, you know, tournaments, paid fees, performed reasonably well. We all just met on the green, and I spent the morning essentially crouched down reading their faces as they made a variety of putts. And then, of course, we could naturally see how they performed. So here are your seven choices, because I'm going to be asking you which expression or which emotion expressed on their faces proved the most helpful and the most detrimental to being an effective putter. So the choices would be happiness, surprise, fear, anger, sadness, disgust, and contempt. Of those seven, which one do you think actually was most conducive to putting well, and which, at least from our little mini experiment, seemed to be the most harmful?
I would veer between, copping out here, aren't I? Between surprise and happiness, and anger and fear would be the other end of the scale.
Okay, and ours was a limited sample, so I will not defend this in a court of law, but I will tell you that actually from our little experiment, slight anger, as in concentration almost, was actually the most effective. And that does correlate to some other work I did, which was paid work, which was for the U.S. Olympic diving team before they competed in Rio. And as I watched the interactions between the coach and the diver high on the platform, they had a little routine, at least most of them did, where they would exchange a knowing smile between them, I suppose, to reaffirm their connection and a boost of confidence. I actually found it was detrimental to their diving, and the divers who instead showed that kind of purposeful, concentrated anger did the best, and they shifted their routine. They dropped that before they headed to the Olympics. So that's what I found. And the least effective, contempt. The smirk, the knowing smirk that I'm above you, this, I of course will make the putt. I think almost the supposition that I'm in control because you're actually not in control. Anyway, the person was so intrigued. She just wasn't willing to pay my fare, so I didn't take the offer. But there was a conference on golf analytics with the event being held at St. Andrews in Scotland, and I was invited to speak to show my results, but you know, since that wasn't really my calling in life, and I was going to pay the fare, and I'd been to Scotland before, I passed. But I sometimes regret it, actually, because I've not been on the course, and of course it's very historic and wonderful and extremely daunting and all those things. So a couple other questions in golf here. We're near the end. So in tennis, it's often said that the seventh game of the set is really a crucial game, because then you're up 4-3 and you're just nosing that much better to closing out the set on your behalf. In golf, given the structure of your book in 18 holes, is there a point? I mean, because obviously in tennis you'd say, well, you know, it's add in or add out, or, you know, in the tiebreaker, but, you know, that seventh game can loom large, people believe. In golf, is there a hole, you know, out of the 18 holes, is there a hole that's kind of in some subtle way might be the harbinger of how this thing's going to go?
I don't think I generalize. I think there's probably different holes that symbolize different things. Like in the book, I sort of comment on the first hole and how people set off on the first hole and maybe they hit two bad shots, and then they define their whole round because of those two bad shots. Oh, it's not going to be my day, or or how unlucky, or whatever. So often the first hole, I think, can be significant. And then, of course, in golf, and particularly in links golf, you've got the ninth, which is the turn. So in links golf, you're normally playing along the coast one way and then back along the coast the other way. So it literally is a turn. So it's a significant sort of halfway stage, but also a psychological stage. So, like, you know, will I hold it together, or will my fortunes change, and will the zone find me in the next nine?
Okay, well, you know, as I said, I have no talents in golf, but when I have played, I've found for myself about the 12th hole really becomes the moment I have to dig deeper, because now I've encountered enough frustrations that if I'm gonna salvage anything, I have to dig a bit deeper and find some inner tranquility that allows me to go on, because there's usually not, in my case, been a lot of positive signs.
Yeah, well, it can catch you as well. I mean, ego is a big factor in this, because it can catch you. Like, you can be playing well, and there again is that thing, I'm playing well. So the theme of the book is no one playing, of course. So as soon as we go, I'm playing well, then there's a potential for trouble.
Sure. So, speaking of highs and lows and trouble, I can't leave this interview without asking you about Tiger Woods. That'll be my last question. And any observations? If Tiger was your patient, what would you say to him?
Well, teach me how to swing, probably. that's been a whole fascinating process, hasn't it? What an astounding golfer, and again, sort of classically. We've got hubris, you know. So we've got the fall from grace, which is just extraordinary to watch in any sport or in any situation, really. And what I would say is that he's come back from that, and it looks like it's impacted him deeply, and in a sense, that's the design of our fall from grace. Is to realize our humility and still keep the qualities that we have in life or in golf or whatever. And I think he's done a great job with that. But it's extraordinary watching people come to earth in that way, and then watching how they survive it and how they come through it. And he's done well with that. What an amazing journey.
Yeah, no, you know, you can read the Greek, you know, heroic tragedies, or you can look at Tiger Woods' life, but it has been an epic journey. That's absolutely true. So we've reached the end of our particular journey, Martin. I do want to thank you for being my guest on Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. This has been episode number 92. Letting the Nothingness into Your Swing. My guest, Martin Wells, he's the author of, indeed, No One Playing, The Essence of Mindfulness in Golf and in Life. If you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. You can find other episodes by going to my company's website at the obligatory 3 W's and sensorylogic.com, or go to the New Books Network website and search by typing in the show's name. Finally, I'd like to conclude every episode with an epigram. In this case, I took one actually from a Buddhist nun who I know nothing else about. The person's name, Pema Chodron. This person said, "Nothing ever goes away until it has taught us what we need to know." I found that intriguing. Until next time, take care and be well.